The Institute.
Institute.
Institute for Justice.
The National Law Firm for Liberty.
Hello, and welcome to Short Circuit, your podcast on the Federal Courts of Appeals. I'm your host, Anthony Sanders, Director of the Center for Judicial Engagement at the Institute for Justice. This week, we're going to be talking about something that is near and dear to pretty much everyone in the country, which is getting pulled over by the police while you're driving. This may have happened to you. It has happened to me. It may have happened to our guest in the past. And when it happens, you want to know what your rights are and how those rights might vary depending on where you are driving. So I have with us today a dear friend and colleague, Wesley Hoddit. Wesley was on the show not long ago talking about some other issues. He's back today to talk about roadside stops, and we'll be presenting a case. But he's better known, perhaps, as the resident Institute for Justice birder. And you may not know this from the podcast, but last time we had him on, we announced this on Twitter. He actually he talked a little bit about birds, and then he found a kind of unusual bird for the area out the window and took a picture of it, which we later posted. So, Wesley, do you have your camera ready? Have you seen some birds in the neighborhood that you want to tell us about?
I have a camera on my desk. It's maybe not the best, but yeah, just before we started, I was hearing a Cooper's hawk cry out the window after hearing all the neighborhood birds screaming and yelling about its presence. So yeah, I mean, every day there's something magical out there.
Yeah. Well, Cooper's hawk I always like because, you know, you get the red-tail hawks, and where I live, the turkey vultures all the time, but the Cooper's hawk kind of mixes up the bird of prey mix I enjoy. And then, of course, there's the smaller hawks too.
Right, like the Sharpie. These are accipiters or bird hunters.
Yeah, well, bird hunters is one thing. Automobile hunters is another. We'll get to those in a moment. First, though, for listeners who listened last week and also who have followed our Twitter account, you know that we are currently hunting for the most beautiful federal circuit court courtroom in the country. We announced this last week. We put it out on our Twitter account. And I'm very happy to say a lot of people got back to us with their favorite courtrooms. We've heard, especially Ninth Circuit. Ninth Circuit seems to have some very nice courthouses and courtrooms. A few elsewhere in the country. We're looking again for there's some beautiful state courthouses and district courthouses, but we're especially looking because we're short circuit for circuit court, federal circuit court courtrooms, not just a courthouse, but courtrooms where you go in there and you're just like, you know, this is just a lovely place to be. So, Wesley, I believe you have a nomination that you weren't the only one who nominated, I think.
Yeah, the Pioneer Courthouse that the Ninth Circuit uses when they sit in Portland, Oregon, I think is really beautiful. I don't know the exact dates, but, you know, was built sometime in the 19th century. And, you know, I quipped that it's a place where you can either strike it rich out west or die of dysentery, depending on the quality of your appeal.
That's true. Well, we will be talking about driving down the Oregon Trail later in this episode. But first, I want to hear what you have to say about driving in the Eighth Circuit.
Yeah, this is a really interesting case, United States versus Shoemaker, decided by the Eighth Circuit. Levinsky Smith, the chief judge of the Eighth, is the author of the opinion, with Strauss and Grunder both agreeing. So it's a unanimous panel looking at a motion to suppress that was denied in the district court, where the criminal defendant facing an armed career criminal count, that is a felon in possession criminal violation that can send you to jail for, well, it's a statutory minimum 15 years if you get hit with it ultimately.
Wow.
But as you have to do in Fourth Amendment law, it's not what the police found and ultimately prosecuted you for, but rather you got to rewind the tape to the moment that they engaged the person and to evaluate the constitutionality of the stop and seizure. And in this case, that initiating event was the officer smelling marijuana. Allegedly, they smelled burnt marijuana from inside their police car with only two of four windows down. There are three officers in this vehicle. The front passenger and driver's side windows are up. The back windows are down. There's the third officer sitting in the back. And, you know, the sum of the testimony is that they see a vehicle kind of closely turn in front of another vehicle, not quite cutting it off, but, you know, maybe driving a little bit unsafely. And though they had been following the vehicle that was cut off for some time and had not been smelling marijuana, they allegedly begin smelling it at the point of this near miss. And so they start following the target vehicle, and they're about 100 meters away from this thing. So the length of a 100-yard dash, or, you know, the length of a 100-meter race in track and field, I mean to say, for our Euro friends. With the windows up, they're allegedly smelling these guys smoking pot. Now, when they stop the car, they discover that, you know, there's no smoke in the vehicle. There's no embers. There's no lit marijuana cigarette. But inside the car's ashtray, remember cars used to have ashtrays. Inside the car's ashtray, there is something like a dozen used marijuana cigarettes, one looking fresher than the others, but all of them extinguished. And so the defendant is saying, hey, it's implausible that you were able to smell me even smoking marijuana from inside a half-sealed car 100 meters behind us. And they actually went and got a pretty reputable expert witness from the University of Pennsylvania's like smell center or something like that to testify to the actual wind conditions on the ground that day, the sort of pervasiveness of marijuana as a subject. And the United States also had an expert. So this is like a heavily litigated thing. This guy is a former police officer, as you might imagine, who now trains other officers. Interestingly, as an aside, does so through this controversial private company, Desert Snow, that teaches officers around the country how to be more aggressive, at least from the perspective of criminal justice reformers. But that's a discussion for another day. The United States expert is saying, no, in my experience as an officer and in training other officers, it's common that you can zero in on the smell of marijuana being smoked. And here I have to say that for once, I find myself in the uncomfortable position of agreeing with the police. I mean, just in my personal experience from living in Washington, D.C., and now Seattle, Washington, I have smelled marijuana on the street and then sort of looked around and realized, oh, hey, it's coming from right there. And sure enough, from time to time, there's confirmation of that in the form of, like, you know, a lit marijuana cigarette or something like that. I do think it's possible, especially in this day and age of particularly potent and pungent marijuana, that you can use your olfactory senses to zero in on where it's coming from. Now, whether you can do that in a moving vehicle with 15 to 17 mile an hour winds, as the experts were saying, that at times may have been blowing the smoke elsewhere, and at other times may have been where the cops may have been downwind, in the ideal position, we're told, to smell something like this. I don't know. I mean, I'm open to both sides. What's really interesting to me about the opinion is the extent to which the court goes to explain all of this. This is a unanimous 18-page opinion going to great lengths to explain that the relevant standard here is clear error of the factual determinations of the district court. and laying out all of the things the district court found and essentially saying, hey, you know, maybe this is unfair, maybe it's not, but our job is to review these factual determinations for clear error, and we can't do so. I mean, they point to some relevant authority out of, I'm forgetting which circuit it is now, but I think it's the Seventh, that reaches the opposite conclusion on much stronger factual conclusions for the defendant. And it seemed to me that despite being kind of counter to my priors, that this was an example of, if not good police work, then at least good judging, in that they knew what the standard of review was. They knew how this would ring false, you know, to a lot of people's ears. And so they go to, I thought, admirable lengths to explain why they're reaching the conclusion that they're reaching. I mean, maybe I'm growing soft in my old age.
Well, I think I'm not quite as soft as you are here, Wesley, but I do see where you're coming from. They do start out the background of the case. This case depends heavily upon its facts. And that's absolutely true. And it's also absolutely true that the case relies heavily upon credibility determinations of the testimony of the witnesses, right, especially these three officers. And so even if the Eighth Circuit's skeptical of, you know, the police in general, I'm not saying it is or it isn't of these judges, that they're kind of left with what the district court said about who was credible and who wasn't.
That's right. I mean, make no mistake, I think this is a buzzsaw of a panel for any defendant. And make no mistake, I know that the stakes here are, you know, very, very high for this defendant. Like I said, if he gets hit with even one count of being an armed career felon, an armed criminal in possession, what we used to call a felon in possession, he's going to get a statutory minimum of 15 years. I mean, that's life-changing to a degree that, you know, I can understand why this was so hard fought. However, I do feel like if I was on this panel, despite being, you know, very disagreeable with these three judges at times on criminal justice issues, I probably would have voted with them.
Well, I want to get maybe at the end of our discussion, before we turn to the other case, get into the anatomy and maybe like what the search was here and what was needed to do the search. But first, let's talk maybe my disagreement with you about the evidence. So as you said, and this didn't come up enough, I think, in their opinion, I guess probably because there's no dissent, but the officers are sitting there. It's a little hard to maybe for our audience just listening to us to conceptualize, but the cops are sitting there behind another car at an intersection. The car that has the defendant in it makes what to it? It is a left turn, but to the right from the officers are looking onto this next street. And it does it in kind of a little bit of a crazy way, in the way that should draw attention to it. And I don't exactly know what it looked like, but they probably were like, that's kind of a shady looking car, right? And so in doing that, they probably had some good police work in police instincts in looking at that happen. But then they say, we're 100 meters away from this car that looks shady, and we smell marijuana. I can't see any way you could smell burnt marijuana from 100 meters away unless it's like a bonfire of that stuff. If there's just someone smoking a roach, which apparently it looks like this guy was, and then he put it out in his ashtray, I just can't see how they testify that they smelt that. Now, then what they do is they turn right and they get up, and there are only two cars behind this car. And apparently, like we were talking before we recorded, apparently the car didn't make any other traffic violations, which, you know, almost all of us make, you know, every minute we're on the road, even if it's just going over the speed limit. But somehow they didn't make a traffic violation. This guy didn't. And so they didn't pull him over on something else, which I think, you know, whether you think that's good law, good constitutional law or not, that the police can always pull you over for something, I think it's pretty bad. You think they'd be able to do that. They don't. But they say that they smelt the marijuana more when they got close to him. I think that's more likely, that if you say, especially if they're right behind this car and they're stopped at an intersection and you smell a bit of marijuana, that's plausible. But what's not plausible is they're 100 meters away, and yet that's their testimony, which should make the credibility of everything else they say, other than stuff that's backed up by the camera. And there was a camera. It wasn't clear whether there was audio from the camera. Maybe there was, but I think
there was. I mean, that was something I found very persuasive, was that the district court's findings have interwoven the dash cam footage of the encounter,
right,
on which you can hear the three officers saying to each other, discussing how they smell marijuana.
That smells like weed, I think they say at
right.
one point.
Presumably they were doing so in a way that did not sound contrived, but rather quite natural. And the district court points out, indeed, they're talking to themselves about how it's amongst themselves about how it's getting stronger as they get closer to the vehicle. As they approach the vehicle, they're saying on their body cams to each other, like, man, that's strong, isn't it? And then the defendant himself is admitting on these same tapes, like, yes, the car smells like marijuana. Yes, there are these cigarettes in it. Yes, I was just smoking right before I got in the car, right? Which by itself, right, is a crime. Now, granted, they discovered it by following their noses, as it were. But there seems to there for me, it's important that there's this corroborating video on which, unless they're brilliant actors, they've managed to persuade the district court in media res that they were persuaded they were smelling pot.
Well, and I would not be surprised if there are police out there who say things when they know they're being recorded by their dash cam camera that actually are not true. Like, of course.
Well, there was this example recently where this guy's being recorded and he very shrewdly starts playing loudly like a Taylor Swift song so that it can't be uploaded to YouTube without being taken down.
Well, yeah, that's a neat trick that we've heard about in the past. I think all of that put, as I was saying, does say that the police had some good facts here. But that initial fact, I do not believe. And so I don't know whether to credit them with everything out. But where the the Eighth Circuit was sitting in reviewing the credibility determinations of these officers, I admit, would I have done the same thing as that panel? I really don't know. Let's turn now to the actual search. And this is the, as you said, the tragic thing. This guy, right, it's in Iowa where I'm not sure the latest weed law, it's always changing around the country, of course, but I think basically the marijuana that he had with him was illegal in some way. Of course, it's legal under federal law anyway. But he has a gun with him, which he claims is his girlfriend's. But I don't know whether that's true or not, but it leads to this prosecution. And the gun is just, it's hidden in the car, but he actually volunteers. There's a gun in the car. So the guy was trying to cooperate with the officers. And perhaps, the end result is this is a minor traffic stop about a very minor crime, but because he happened to have this firearm with him, which, we could argue about whether that law is just. Certainly the penalty is not just. He's going away for a very long time.
I mean, there's no doubt. It doesn't matter whether it's his girlfriend's gun or not. He's in possession of it at the moment.
That's what I thought.
It's loaded. He has this felony record. And, I mean, I think there's no question that there are serious policy problems with cart, like everyone across the board gets a 15-year minimum sentence. Some people get more for that crime. And this is all based on what appears to have at worst been an act of driving under the influence.
Yeah. So just we'll quickly wrap up this case. As I see it, so if we think about the various things that the police did that might have a problem with the Fourth Amendment. The police pull you over, or they force you to pull over by turning their lights on, right? you know you have to pull over. That's a seizure because they're seizing your car, forcing it to pull over, and your person. Then what they do, they ask him to get out of the car, which I think we could probably qualify as a Terry stop, or it's part of the initial seizure. And then apologies to criminal defense lawyers who know we're butchering some of this right now, but this is what we want to get across to the audience. Then they search. I don't think they had permission. They search his ashtray. So that's a search. But they had probable cause for the search, obviously, because it reeked of marijuana. And then they also search his console for the gun. And that, I guess we could say, was either probable cause. I don't know how. I guess they had probable cause to look for contraband, and instead they found a gun. Or maybe we could call it a Terry stop, which is where you look to make sure the officer is safe, and you just have to have some kind of reasonable suspicion for that. Is that the anatomy you see of what the police did here, and where they, you know, where they needed probable cause, where they needed something else?
Yeah, I mean, that's almost entirely right. You know, I mean, the Fourth Amendment law really turns on these very fine distinctions, and so. You know, I mean, even those of us that work with it at times, if you don't do it every day, it's hard sometimes to articulate it based on particular facts. But with that said, the police needed reasonable suspicion to initiate the stop. They needed to believe that, you know, a crime had occurred, not to the degree of probable cause, certainly not to the degree of preponderance, and nowhere near a degree of beyond a reasonable doubt, right? So the Eighth Circuit points out, we know it has to be more than a hunch that a crime has occurred, but it doesn't have to be likely that a crime occurred. There just has to be a reasonable suspicion. So whether or not you think it's reasonable that 100 meters they smell pot, or whether you think it's reasonable that they do so at 50 meters or 25 or 5, at some point in there, they credibly claim to have smelled pot. That then gives them the right to pull the vehicle over. Now, you're right, we're in Terry land, where once the vehicle's pulled over, particularly under the automobile exception, which is, I think, something you want to get to later in the podcast, they have the right to search that vehicle, either ultimately do an inventory search if they have
to tow it, basically.
Right, if they have to tow it and hold it for evidence, or even if they say they have probable cause to seize it. You know, the officer safety component comes in at that point, where they're supposed to be able to look for guns and bombs and you know, powders and things like that that could harm them in the process. So, I mean, granted, I don't like feeling like this case came out correctly, but I think on the law it did.
Well, that may be true. That may not be true. But let's turn to another case where things came out a little differently. Now, one thing that did not happen in this case we just discussed from the Eighth Circuit, which again is United States versus Shoemaker, is there was no warrant, and it never even comes up, and that's because under the Fourth Amendment has been interpreted by the federal courts, the police do not need a warrant to search an automobile after they pull it over if they have probable cause for the search. So if they pull you over speeding, there's nothing else weird, they can't just search your car. But if they have probable cause, you have drugs somewhere in the car, they can without going to get a warrant. Now, that used to be, until very recently, true in Oregon under the Oregon Constitution. So this is a case, State of Oregon versus McCarthy, which just came out last week. And I wrote a blog post about this for the Center for Judicial Engagement blog, which we'll put a link up to. And you guys very happy if you spend some time reading it, and other things we put on the blog from time to time. I try to do a post each week on state constitutional law. And this was a new development in state constitutional law in Oregon. But it also goes into a lot of the same issues that Wesley just talked about in the Eighth Circuit case. So the state of Oregon, like just about every state, has a provision in its constitution that's a lot like the Fourth Amendment that bans unreasonable searches and seizures and says if you get a warrant, then you need to have a probable cause. But the kind of unanswered question in a lot of, well, it's often answered, but in different ways in Fourth Amendment law and then in state equivalents to that is when is it unreasonable? When is a search or seizure unreasonable because you didn't get a warrant? So say you have probable cause, but you don't go get a warrant. Is that unreasonable? Now, usually if the police are going to search your home, they need to get a warrant even if they have probable cause. That's because it's considered it's not reasonable. So you need a warrant to have a search or a seizure unless there's an exception. The problem is it's like Swiss cheese when it comes to the Fourth Amendment and exceptions. There's exceptions for the warrant requirement for all kinds of things, and a search can still be reasonable. So the federal courts have said that you don't need a warrant to do a search of the car after pulling it over. Usually pulling it over isn't a deal like it was in the Eighth Circuit case because, if you're going 7 miles per hour over, there's obviously essentially a crime, even though it's a very minor crime, committed in the officer's presence. And so under an old common law exception, the police can then pull you over and detain you and, ticket you. But to expand that into a search of the car, they at least need probable cause. But again, the federal courts have said you don't need a warrant. And that's because cars are mobile. You could drive away before they go and get a warrant. And so they just get rid of the warrant requirement entirely. So what happened in Oregon is in the 80s, the Supreme Court of Oregon said, we're going to follow federal law in interpreting our own state constitution, the equivalent to the Fourth Amendment, which is Article 1, Section 9. So years pass by, and we have this case, McCarthy, where there are, and so these guys in this case, maybe even more than Wesley case, very much are not saintly characters who are involved, including the defendants. I guess they're very much suspected heroin dealers. They're driving in a car. There was a stakeout of a house. They come out of the house, drive away in the car. The police follow the car. The car then veers into a bike lane, which, monstrous crime that none of us have ever engaged with. And so they pull the car over on that supposition that they veered into a bike lane. Of course, the real reason they pull them over is because they're these heroin guys they've been staking out. They park in a parking lot in a legal parking space. And then there's a kind of series of comedy of errors that ensues where the driver didn't have proper license. They call the actual registered owner of the car. He's not the owner of the car. The owner of the car comes. Turns out he has an outstanding warrant. They bring a drug dog. The drug dog alerts on the car where the passengers are. So they arrest the passengers on suspicion of possessing drugs. So everyone's arrested. Everyone who could potentially drive this car away has been detained. The car is effectively not mobile other than just it's an operational vehicle. But the police still don't go and get a warrant. They search the car because they think they have probable cause. There's drugs in the car because these guys are known drug dealers. They actually had stains on their hands that looked like they were making, cooking up heroin. Other kinds of details I won't bother you with. And they find, lo and behold, heroin in the car. So there's prosecution. There's a motion to suppress, as we had in the other case. And this goes, this is really interesting. Even though there's this law that says you don't need a warrant for an operational vehicle when you're looking for drugs, the trial judge is just can't believe what these police did. They were at the scene for, I think, over half an hour before they arrested everyone and did the search. It was 1:30 in the afternoon. It was a weekday. The courthouse is nearby, and there's actually a state law that allows for telephonic warrants and all these things you can do in our modern age, right? Where you have a You have a police radio. You have a mobile computer, of course, in every police car now. You have a cell phone. You could get some kind of a warrant pretty quickly by just calling up the court. There's 14 judges at the county court. This is Marion County, Oregon. So it's where the capital, Salem, is. And the judge says, you know, no one ever calls me about these warrants. And the responses, which I find amazing, from the county, both from the county prosecutor's office and the policeman, is, well, we just don't do that. We just don't do telephonic warrants. It's not available. And so that's why we didn't do it. And so we should get the automobile exception to the warrant requirement. The trial judge doesn't buy this, despite this case law. It goes to the Court of Appeals, which reverses based on this case from the 80s. And then in this opinion, which unanimous opinion from the Oregon Supreme Court, they reverse this old case law from the 80s and say that, you know, we're not going to follow the federal law on this matter. And we live in an age where you have things like e-scanners, computers. You could do a video chat with the judge. You could even show, you know, this is an opinion, but you could show the judge the car and say, hey, I need a warrant to search this car. There's all kinds of things you could do that weren't available in the 80s when the court said, yeah, it's inherently mobile. We're going to have a bright line exception here. And so they say that just because a car is mobile does not mean you can expand a stop into a search if you have probable cause. You need to try and get a warrant. Now, they'd say that, you know, it could be that that there's exigent circumstances and you can do the search without a warrant. And of course, I'm sure there's going to be all kinds of arguments now in the state of Oregon about when that happens and how narrow, you know, if you're on a rural highway, if it's in the middle of the night, and so there's only maybe a magistrate on duty and he's asleep, or, you know, whatever the excuse is, there's going to be times when there are going to be searches and they say you don't have to get a warrant. But just because you have a car does not mean the police can search without a warrant, which is different than under federal law in most other states. So it's an interesting state constitutional opinion, and I think most interesting because it shows how the technology has been changing. And they even cite a couple recent U.S. Supreme Court cases where the Supremes have been kind of hinting at this in other contexts that, look, you can call – Chief Justice Roberts said, look, you can – there's some places – where you can call up and get a warrant in 15 minutes. And so I think it might only be a matter of time before the U.S. Supremes start to revisit the core of the what we've been calling the automobile exception.
Yeah, I mean, I think Carpenter is probably the hook for that doctrinal change, where there's the recognition that the sensitivity of sort of tracking your cell phone justified for a majority of SCOTUS a warrant requirement. And, you know, in my experience, police can get a warrant for just about anything within 30 minutes. Now, granted, that might not be true in every jurisdiction, but it has always struck me since law school to be really strange that that more police and prosecutors don't just paper the record with warrants to completely cut off this huge debt weight loss of having to litigate this, right? I mean, they can get a rubber stamp magistrate signature. Indeed, at least in Washington State, the officer can sign it himself with the authorization of the judge over the phone. And maybe this is why I'm not a government attorney, but if I were counseling them on the law, I would say, like, just get as many warrants as you can, man. Like, I know you want to get on with your day, but it's not that hard.
I mean, it really seems to be, because there's been other cases, you know, where similar discussion has happened, where the district attorney is just like, we just don't do this. Or the police say, well, you know, it would take, because one cop in this opinion said, he testified that it would take at least four hours to get a warrant.
Give me a break.
And I think a lot of it is just, it is relatively easy, but it's paperwork. And these are people who already deal with a lot of paperwork. And so, you know, if they have a way to not do, that's not, of course, why they became police officers, was to fill out paperwork, even though it's a big part of the job. And it's just kind of that bureaucratic, you know, initiative. I've seen the same thing in a different area of Fourth Amendment law, administrative warrants, where the city wants to do a rental inspection of a house and the renter just says, buzz off, I don't want you here. It's pretty darn easy for the city to then go get a warrant. They don't even need evidence there's anything wrong with the house. They just need to say, well, we're doing it for everyone's safety and we need to get in. But even then, cities will bend over backwards not to go get a warrant. They'll just say that they can, you know, that they can do, they can use other means like fine the person or take away the rental license, and so they have to be evicted or things like that. And you wonder, it's just a couple hours of city attorney's time to get this warrant. And I think there's some kind of bright line there where, you know, that it's a some kind of bureaucratic reason why they don't like stepping into that.
Well, doubtless that's part of it. And I'm sympathetic to that on a human level, but
of course.
it is simultaneously true that that these sorts of formalities, even when they do strike us as being low hurdles to cross, that these sort of formalities matter to the recognition of constitutional rights. Because I think what you're really seeing reflected is they don't want to do the unimportant paperwork. And unfortunately, initiating stops and potentially innocent people is not something that they regard as important enough to do that paperwork. And courts are, you know, allowing that kind of mentality and behavior, or have been over the last few decades. And, you know, there's a reason why a judge wears a robe and we all stand up when he comes into the room. There's a reason why we formalize our marriages typically in ceremonies with people there. And there's a reason why our Constitution has a general warrant requirement. It's because we found as a country that living in the alternative was a police state. And it says something about the state of respect for the Constitution that police and prosecutors will say to a judge, we don't do that. Why would we do that? Because it shows a contempt for the underlying principle.
And of course, there's the piece that if the police are not asking for a warrant, are not asking for some third party to sign off, there of course is the possibility that they will push the envelope and do searches without the minimum probable cause. And you might ask, well, why would they do that? In fact, Justice Scalia asked this in one of the last couple terms he was still around in a drug dog sniff case. Why would they do that? And it's because there's all, you know, very few traffic stops end up in court later where that probable cause might be challenged. And so, well, you know, I want to look around. I want to see what's in the vehicle. Now, not the only reason, but a big part of that, as listeners well know, and us at IJ know the most, is civil forfeiture, that they might find a lot of cash in the car, maybe not drugs, but cash. And, you know, that can be seized, given to the police officer's budget. And then it's a real hassle for the person to go and get it back, even if it's completely lawful. And when Justice Scalia asked that question, he's like, "Well, why would they have drug dogs, you know, do false alerts on cars? What's the incentive for the officer there?" Because he's thinking, "Well, if they don't find drugs, then no one's going to be arrested. So why is the officer not doing it?" But he's not thinking of the whole panoply of what the officer might be looking for, which could be there might be cash in there, even though the cash is not what's actually alerting the drug dog. Having a warrant requirement, having the officer phone into the magistrate, I think just is a very vital second check on that. And so it's good to see that there's a bit of that second check now in our friends in the state of Oregon.
Yeah. And it's, I think, an exciting time to be launching into, as IJ is, more search and seizure work. We've got folks looking at how this Oregon decision could be used to springboard federal change and change in other states. You know, I'm looking at a memo now. There are 9 states now, with Oregon joining the previous 8, that reject the automobile exception. There are 30 that clearly embrace it, and about 11 that we find to be unclear. That's how you start a march toward a CERT grant.
And that is as part of IJ's project on the Fourth Amendment, which if you're more interested in the Fourth Amendment and other issues, privacy issues and the right to be secure, we encourage you to check us out on the webpage and our colleagues who are part of our Fourth Amendment project, including Wesley. I want to remind everybody what I said at the beginning of this podcast, which is, if you have a favorite federal circuit courtroom, please let us know. We're going to be holding this open for the next couple of weeks. Maybe you agree with Wesley about Portland in the state of Oregon. Maybe Pasadena is more your thing. Maybe you agree with me, the courthouse in Atlanta, which I thought was just beautiful when I was there last month. We'd love to hear from you. So you can email me. You can find that on the show notes and click through to profile, or you can hit us up on Twitter, or you can send us smoke signals, however you want to do that. We'd love to hear from you. And Wesley, we always love to hear from you. So thanks for coming on.
Oh, you're welcome. And hey, I just want to say for the listeners, if you are going to send us any sort of smoke signals, just make sure you don't have a loaded weapon if you've got a prior felony.
Yeah, that's a real good tip. I think everyone appreciates that. And what we also appreciate is for all of you to get engaged.